Hello and welcome back to another episode and another year of Is This Just Fantasy? I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the man who's only his friend because our fathers told us we had to be, Duncan Nichol.
And we are kicking off the year with one hell of a pull, Duncan. This really was outside of our typical wheelhouse. No Brandon Sanderson here, that's for sure. We read The Legend of the Condor Heroes, Part 1. Emphasis on the Part 1 part, Duncan. A Hero Born by... God, I've already lost confidence. By Jin Yong.
If it means anything, that's their pen name. Their actual name is Luis. Or Luis Chung.
Right, I can't believe it. Right from the start, we are already beginning with confusion about names. Because there's a good chance that is going to be a major theme through this episode. Something that surprised me a lot right when I cracked open this book was, one, I've never had an introduction to a book before first tried to persuade me that translating this book was a good idea, actually, which made me feel a bit nervous about how insecure the translator was feeling, and then laid out the plot for the entire series, and I went, wait, this is spoilers, right? What's going on? Throw in some historical context about how cool and influential the book is, and then cap it off by explaining, we're just going to change the character names. So, for example, we're following the stories of Sky Fury Guo and Ironheart Yang, which is not what they're called in the first book. They have actual names. And not all of the names in this book get translated into English. Like, the first hero is Sky Fury Guo, and then we follow his son, Guo Jing. Why didn't Guo Jing get translated?
I mean, we're going to fall over immediately, because I thought it was pronounced Gao the entire novel. Such a great conversation. We're probably going to spend more time this episode discussing the context and the history around the text than any other time ever in the history of this podcast. But before we get into all of that, let's hit our format point, Geordie. Have you been reading, watching, enjoying, experiencing, anything else you want to share with us?
I won't get into it too much. After recording our episode on the end of the year and then editing the episode on the end of the year, I got a hankering to do some unfinished business, and I'm now currently reading Tarzan.
Oh, that's exciting. No, that's really exciting. After our end of year episode, I was like, when is he ever going to get back around to this? How are you finding it? How far are you in?
I had not read as much of that book as I thought I had. I was a sizable portion in. I was on chapter 2. I really remembered me being like a quarter of the way through, but I was not. I'm like 11 chapters in, so, you know, Tarzan has now discovered he's a human being. His parents are dead. And, God, this is definitely the most racist book I've ever read.
Yes. Yes, yeah. There's a lot to unpack in that book. But it is, it's bad.
It's real bad. I don't want to get distracted because we have so much to cover this episode. So I'll put this very briefly. There's this truly bizarre sequence of scenes where Tarzan is figuring out that he's a human being. And like he's seen in books, like pictures of people from England. So he's seen pictures of white people and he's seen pictures of black people. But he has figured out that, you know, they're all human beings. He knows he's not an ape. And then he meets Africans in person for the first time. He has like a fight with someone. He kills him. And then he starts hacking him up to eat him. Because, you know, because Tarzan doesn't know what it's like to be a human being. And yet, before he can bring himself to eat this human being, something in him that he doesn't understand tells him that, no, I can't do this. This is wrong. So you get the feeling that, oh, is Edgar Rice Burroughs saying that the thing that's separating Tarzan from not being an animal, but being a man, a human being, is a sort of innate morality? You know, perhaps even something coming down from God. And then, the next scene, he tracks down this hunter to his village and discovers that the village, they're all cannibals. So it's like, oh no, Tarzan has innate morality. But these guys don't. Ooh.
Burroughs definitely has this attitude. And it goes beyond even what you've seen that first bit of like, not Tarzan isn't just like morally superior because he's a white person in this world. Like Barbara Streisand also really kind of hammers home this idea that because he descended from like gentry and like the upper classes, that's given him even more innate superiority.
And physically, there's a bit in it where, first of all, Tarzan is described at 10 years old as being as strong as a 30-year-old man, which is very funny because he's amongst apes. But Burroughs is very explicit that him coming from aristocrats means he has, like, the blood of ancient warriors.
Only it was fantasy.
Anyway, what have you been reading?
Pick it apart. I have been reading, well, I have finally... Geordie, it was my birthday earlier this month.
Happy birthday, Duncan. Yeah,
Thank you very much.
A week ago, right?
Yep. Last Saturday, I have finally left my 20s. I'm 30 years old. It's hurting a little bit on the inside.
Did you do anything nice?
I did, actually. I went to a comedy club. It's a fun time. I love it. I like seeing that kind of real mix of comedians. I also really enjoyed it. It was a really good... Like, I've been seeing a lot of comedy, and it really makes me notice sometimes how much just the people, the crowd... impact sort of your enjoyment, even if you're enjoying the comedian to like the same level.
Yes,
being in a crowd that also kind of buzzing and have that vibe and are laughing just brings it out of you more. And this definitely was. I was a bit worried going to a comedy club like that soon after Christmas, everyone would be kind of then like come down, but no, really nice vibe, everyone's on the same page. Particularly like a lot of the comedy, you know, maybe is poking at like social issues in the world. So if the audience aren't on vaguely the same page, it can definitely get awkward fast. But we were. It was a great time. And not only that, I got a load of comics. All Robert E. Howard inspired. So thank you to everyone who gifted me those. They're amazing. I've got a new adaptation of Shadow Kingdom, which I'm thrilled to get into. There's a great read. There's a new Solomon Kane comic that came out. Of course, Solomon Kane and the Servant's Ring. I love to see Solomon Kane is one of Robert E. Howard's lesser known, probably some in the upper tiers, top three Sword and Sorcery heroes. But he's not Conan, so it's nice to see a bit of love for the character. And then finally, a great present I got was a copy of Conan the Barbarian. I think it's called Battle of the Blackstone. It's like an event comic written by Jim Zub.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
I got a signed copy. And it's made me very happy.
Oh, good.
A little extra. So
what a nice little haul, Duncan. So when we did our episode just after Christmas, I hadn't really put two and two together. You were like, oh yeah, we're not doing presents for Christmas this year. But my birthday is a week after Christmas, so...
Yeah. It just works. Listen, mate, when you have a early January birthday, you live a life of people getting you joint Christmas birthday presents. So eventually, like, guys, stop the masquerade. I get it. Just save it and give it to me a week later. It's fine.
That's fair. Quick question. When is your partner's birthday?
I'm a solid 19 hours older.
You cradle snatcher.
We found out, actually, she was born at, like, 10 to 1 in the morning, so she's only 15 minutes away from having the same birthday. And we're saying how grateful we are that her mother held out just that little longer to carry her over midnight. Because I think having the same birthday would be too much.
Yeah, it was definitely the mum who was being stubborn about it. She was like, no, let's keep this going. Shall we talk about the book?
Legend of the Condor Heroes, Part 1, A Hero Born. Geordie, this is something so different. So people, you want a bit of background. Jin Yong is a very prolific Chinese author. Started writing in Hong Kong in, I think it was 1957, was when the first of the Legend of Condor Heroes started to come out. These stories were originally serialized in newspapers. What's kind of note to this is the fact that quite often when you talk about the Legend of Condor Heroes, it gets framed as a trilogy. It is, but also it was serialized. So the trilogy books are so massive when they've been released and translated into the English speaking world. Each book then got subdivided into like 4+ volumes. So what we're technically reviewing today is...
Which I only found out a half hour ago. So when I finished this book, I was like, whoa, what a cliffhanger. They really want me to read the next book. And I discover, right before recording this, the book isn't finished. It didn't end, it stopped. I haven't finished the book yet.
Geordi, we do not have the capacity in our bi-weekly schedule to do a Legend of the Condor Heroes book in a wanna. It is massive. But the key point here being, like I said, it was serialized in newspapers. Unlike something like the pulp fiction we talked about before, in things like Elric, Conan, and Fafnir and the Grey Mouser, though, like I said, it was serialized. This was one continuous story. This hasn't been arbitrarily compiled later, although there was a level of revision when it was first published as a book. It was still in the order as written, as how you will experience it when you read the book. I think something that's really worth noting.
Yeah, so like a lot of Dickens' work is, even though Bleak House is an incredibly long book, it's long because it was published sequentially. That's why Oliver Twist is extremely boring if the same scene keeps happening over and over again.
That is probably the best comparison to make, actually, towards, you know, Charles Dickens and the best comparison
would be The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh gosh, yes.
That's a great book.
I've not even read that. I should one day. Next thing to note, why is this really interesting? Why did I really want to look at this story? Because we previously looked at a story that looked at China and Chinese history, and we looked at the fantastical work of the Poppy War. And I want to make this really clear to people at the start of the episode. The Poppy War is someone writing about China and Chinese history, but in a fantasized version of it, firstly, really important, but also writing about it for a Western audience. The Legend of Condor Heroes...
There's a lot of important differences. Like, R.F. Kuang was, I believe, born in China, but she's definitely, you know, Chinese diaspora. She moved away when she was, like, tiny.
Whereas this is a story that was written for a Chinese audience. And I think that changes so much in terms of the assumptions made about what the audience will just know in terms of cultural and historical references.
I did not realize until I was writing down names to remind myself, you know, who Wan Yang Hong Li is, how many of these characters are historical figures. Like, I know when Genghis Khan shows up, I'm like, oh yeah, Temujin, I know this guy. I'm sure these are his actual kids, because I know he had kids. But wait, you're telling me the guy with the gigantic censor full of wine is a real historical guy? He can project wine through his feet!
No, quite right. And obviously, a lot of the historical figures in this book have been fictionalized and embellished, and quite a lot of the time, from what I can gather looking into this, it's like the combination of these like character myths. It's sort of like someone writing something about Robin Hood. Yes, historically, there probably was a bloke who vaguely fit an outline, but these are characters that have already been added to again and again and again and have their own kind of literary canon around them that then Jin Yong is coming along and pulling upon to then populate his story. But that's kind of the shape of it, and I think that's really important to understand and bear in mind. Because when you first pick this up, boy, this is different.
Yeah,
and
first
it's going
to
hit you the head with it.
That first chapter, when you're just sort of finding your feet and the characters are talking about all of this history, these different historical events, and the like political climate in 13th century Song China, it got me really nervous, Duncan, for the book to come, being like, oh, like, is it going to be all like this?
Well, that's the question, Geordi. I don't know where to go next. I feel like, okay, shall we just actually say, because this book, by the way, came highly recommended to me. My partner's cousin, she actually lent me her copy and was like, listen, read this. This is actually one of my favourite series. It's something different. I know it's not to everyone's taste, but if you're someone who likes reading diverse fantasy, I couldn't recommend anything more so than this. And I took her seriously on that recommendation. So Geordi, in like a few words, how did you feel about Hero Born?
I would try to say it in 5 words. Extremely strange, but almost... Oh no, that's too many.
You set the 5 word limit.
But...
Have 6.
Shut up! Extremely strange, but fucking badass.
I was going to go, started odd, then got amazing. Same sentiment, really.
Around chapter 2, when they start kung fu fighting, I genuinely was like, are people allowed to write books like this? In the previous episode, we talked about, like, battles in the Black Company and about how nothing is explained. And then I compared that to Aure Salvatore and about how he, like, explains blow for blow everything that happens in a fight. And that can mean that his fights last an extremely long time and I can lose track of what's actually happening. This is somehow both of those things. Fights are very lengthy. They are laid out in, sometimes in a lot of detail about blow for blow who's doing what. And they are also extraordinarily vague, because sometimes it will just say, Wan Yang Kang used Silent Goose, takes off in the forest. And you go, oh yes, of course he did. I know what that looks like.
I know, and what's so incredible is that I'm sat there going, okay, I don't know a lot about the martial arts. That could be a legitimate thing, although Google isn't saying it's a legitimate thing. And then on top of that, you're like, well, also, this has gone through a translation. So for all I knew, that started out nowhere near. That's just a vague sentiment of what this move's meant to be called.
I did Kung Fu when I was like, I don't know, 11. I enjoy martial arts films. I love, you know, House of the Flying Daggers. They're great films, and you can really feel some of the influence that's here. Either the cross contamination, where it's like, oh no, this guy was inspired by like the martial arts fiction that was happening at the same time, and he put his own spin on it, or this changed the way in which people depicted martial arts in stories like this, because the genre wuxia is like this seminal piece of the seminal genre of Chinese fantasy, which persists to this day. And this is apparently one of the most significant contributions to that genre.
It certainly is. The amount of authors that I found online giving reference to this story, the amount of people kind of talking about its influence in multiple genres across animation, film, TV shows and other literary work is quite incredible. And it's one of those things, like, I don't know how to best describe it. Do you have that moment where you just discover something, you kind of touch the gate on something and you go, oh my gosh, this has such a massive fandom. How have I never crossed paths with this before?
I mean, this is probably the most significant feeling of that I've ever had, because I had never heard of this book. Period. Full stop. I'd never heard of this series before, and now I'm like, oh, it's everywhere. Now, obviously, we're at the risk of, at our first exposure to, like, properly reading a wuxia book, giving all of the credits to one series, when the epilogue, the author's note at the end, makes clear that this is following a tradition which dates back centuries. This is a style of book which people in China have been writing for a long time, sometimes in newspapers. It's new to us, but we shouldn't overstate its influence when we don't know. We don't have the context for that. But when I was reading the book, the feeling I had was, it made me realize something that I already knew but had forgotten, which is how much of, say, anime is inspired by Chinese martial arts films. Hong Kong martial arts films, you know, even long before you even get stuff like Jackie Chan, are extremely, extremely influential to modern American action movies. And I've just mentioned anime. Anime inspires a lot of it focused on martial arts. But what I'm realizing now is that spiritual aspect of Kung Fu, where characters can do ridiculous things, like do insane backflips or mind control their horse because they're so good at horse riding, or drink wine and project it through their feet using the power of their chi. That weird stuff that you see in like an anime, oh, that's right, it comes from like Chinese literature.
It's so nice thing that we've been trying to like map out the genre to finally go, oh my goodness, it's like I've uncovered something. And it's so weird because I haven't uncovered anything. I have found the most famous popular series in this genre ever written.
The front cover of the book says it's the Chinese Lord of the Rings. So imagine if we were, you know, Zhou Di and Dong Kang, and we were like, "Have you, guys, I just discovered this crazy book, Lord of the Rings. Have you heard of this?" I should have said Dong Kang. That would make more sense.
I don't know if I'm on board with that Easternization of our names, but yes, your point stands.
For the hell of it, I went through the extremely rigorous process of punching our names into a "What's my Chinese name?" website, and this is the results I managed to wrangle out of it. Duncan's name turns out pretty easy to translate. Apparently, it could even mean like bright shield, which is cool.
Duncan.
Me, not so much. This was the first draft. And then here's what I managed to end up with.
How about you actually talk us through? Because, let's be fair, this plot of this first volume is both quite complicated in terms of setting up the board, and in many respects, like scene to scene, quite straightforward. So, can you try and just like talk us through what happens in A Hero Born?
Okay. There's a risk of making it too simple and getting, but also getting too bogged down. So I will start with the absolute simplest version, and then we'll go into more detail. It starts off and we're set in the 13th century in China. So that means that the Mongol Empire is on the horizon, but it's not here yet. And the main conflict in the book lies between essentially North and South China.
Now, they don't all consider themselves Chinese because national identity hasn't been invented yet, but it's between the Jin Empire and the Song Empire. The Jin are specifically Song Empire, like ethnically Han, and the Jin Empire is ethnically Xiujiang.
The main characters, the people you think are going to be your main characters but die in chapter 2, so off to a crazy start, are, in my version of the book, Sky Fury Guo and Ironheart Yang. So we already have to stop, Duncan, and talk about translation.
This book has been translated multiple times, sometimes more, sometimes less directly, sometimes leaving in more of the original Chinese names, sometimes doing literal translations. In some versions, so in the notes at the back of my copy of the book, the translator literally goes, "This is a wrong translation, but it's just sort of so popular in the fandom, I just chose to include it."
That sounds familiar to me. So are you also reading the Anna Hollenwood version?
I am indeed.
Okay, good. Because not good as in I feel that's the authentic version. I'm just glad that we can agree what the characters' names are. Sky Fury Guo, I believe, is initially pronounced Guo Xiaotian.
Guo Xiaoshen.
So, which means Sky Fury. But the translator, Anna, hi Anna, has decided we're going to translate that name. And lots of names get translated. So Li Ping becomes Lily Li, and Bao Jiru becomes Chastity Bao. I'm sure I got Jiru wrong. Jirao, maybe.
Bao Jiru.
And it makes sense, right? We already covered it at the start of the episode. It makes it a lot easier for me to actually be like, oh yeah, I remember Chastity. I remember that because that means something to me. And obviously, things are being implied by these character names. The translator wants you to know that Ironheart is called Ironheart. You know? Guess what his name means. It's a joke. I'm being let in on it.
But no, you're right. It's really good. And it's really important because you're right. It's when the author wants to tell you something about the character and their characterization through their name. It's then really important then to do a literal translation. But sorry, we've got the track now. The plot, Geordie.
Right, so these two, they're martial artists and they're farmers, and they're very patriotic towards the Song part of China. They even want to name their kids after a tragedy, a great humiliation. Their names together are Jing Kang. If you put them together, it's named after a national humiliation. But they're best friends. They're martial artists, they have distinct fighting styles, they both have wives, they're both farmers, they both live together, and then they're visited by a Taoist. That's Eternal Spring. The Taoist is so good at martial arts, they have a misunderstanding, which you love to see in a martial arts story, where they start fighting each other. They don't win, but they prove themselves, and this Taoist likes them so much that he's like, I will come back in like when your children are going to be born and I'll teach them martial arts because you're so cool. And then soldiers show up to attack the Taoist. They defeat the soldiers. One of the soldiers is injured but survives. And then Chastity goes out and tends to him whilst he's injured but doesn't tell her husband for some reason. And then later, more soldiers show up, attack them, and kill Sky Fury and appear to kill Ironheart Yang. And then their wives are abducted. But one of the wives is saved by that injured soldier who comes back. His name is, oh, I forget the cover name he gives himself, but it's not real. And Helix is like, oh, I will take you away from here. I'll take you somewhere safe. And then we will avenge your murdered husband. But it turns out he's actually a prince of the Jin Empire. And he's been tricking her this whole time. And then they don't tell you till later, but he led this attack to kill her husband so that he could abduct her and marry her. And then things get crazy. Because the Seven Freaks of the South show up. And there is this extended scene where once again people have a big misunderstanding which leads to a fight. Except this time it's not a fist fight. It's Eternal Spring comes into a pub being like, you evil monk, you've kidnapped a woman who I'm sworn to protect and I'm going to track her down and break into your monastery and beat everyone up. And good God, the way the story goes from here. Because instead of it being just this fight, it's this drinking contest where everyone demonstrates their various skills. Like, oh, I'm the best horse rider ever. I'm Rider Han. And I'm going to drink from this flying disc full of wine upside down on my horse. And someone is like, I'm the greatest acrobat ever, so I'm going to drink this wine whilst doing a bunch of backflips. I'm the best pickpocket ever. And all of them demonstrate their skills one by one to prove how cool they are, but none of them are as good at drinking wine as Eternal Spring. And then the story moves on. Oh, I've accidentally gone into way more detail.
Then what happens is this goes back and forth between Eternal Spring and the Freaks from the South. The Freaks of the South. The Heroes of the South. They have multiple names. It goes down that one of the wife of Sky Fury Gao, was in the monastery, but the monk didn't know. This misunderstanding leads to a fight between Eternal Spring and the Seven Freaks that ends up in the wife being ensconded away by a villainous character. And then Eternal Springs and the Seven make a deal. They basically say, right, there are these two women, both with child, both who need rescuing. We are going to make a deal to prove we're not going to fight each other to see who's best. Whoever can rescue the associated women and then train the child to be the better martial artist by their 18th birthday, they will win this competition between us.
And this was the moment, Duncan, that I bought in. I was enjoying the crazy kung fu stuff that was happening up to this point. I thought it was wacky. But the moment this guy was like, oh, I need to propose. I've dishonored these people by accusing them of a crime and beating the shit out of them. They did eventually have an actual fight. I've dishonored them. So I need to find some way to give them a chance to compete with me again while still maintaining their, you know, how cool they are. And his proposition is, we will commit ourselves for the next 18 years to a bet about who can teach martial arts better. Now go out and find this kid. And I was like, oh my God, that is the most badass and ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
If that was the entire story, it would kind of be enough. The fact of the matter is that isn't even the full extent of what the Legend of the Condor Heroes is about. It's just,
that's literally like, if everything leading up to Mr. Miyagi teaching Daniel's son, was like 50,000 words of novel about him being like, I guess I should teach him karate.
And so it is on. And just to say, the key point of all of this, and my joke at the beginning, is that these two children were sworn by their fathers to be like blood brothers or something of the equivalent. Anyway, so at this point, We then follow the seven freaks of the south as they go to find Sky Fury's Gal's son.
Gore.
This is it, because I read it the whole book wrong.
Imagine it spelt G-W-O-R.
Gore. And where is he?
Why, he's joined the Mongolian hordes, of course.
Of course. He's now working with Genghis Khan.
We should just clarify, like, you said something which, like, is sort of true, but it really implies something quite different. You said we follow the Seven Freaks of the South. The book leaves them for a long time, and it joins, like, the mum, as she's been abducted across, into the Gobi Desert. Like, has left the country, and you're like, oh, fuck, how are they ever going to find her? She's not even in the same country anymore. And then there's an extended section about them becoming Mongolian steppe people. Like, not even, there's no martial arts in this section. It becomes about rearing goats. And then Genghis Khan turns up. And there are no Chinese characters in this book anymore, except for Lily and her son, Guo Jing, who's our new hero. And probably the main hero of the book, I'm going to assume. That seems right, unless some other crazy stuff is going to happen in part two.
You'd be correct. No, Guo Jing is our main character, finally introduced to us a quarter of the way in, properly.
And he's like a six-year-old for a lot of this book. There's just an extended section where it's not following... He's not the main hero here. It's some Mongolian general who has a, like, archery fight with a whole bunch of Genghis Khan's generals, and it's like people are high kicking arrows out of the air.
This is the fight where it's an archery fight. They're on horseback, and he goes like, can I have that bow? And they're like, okay, you can have that bow. And they're like, do you want some arrows with it? And he goes, I don't need arrows.
Yes.
Sorry, I got distracted by how awesome that fight is. Just for the reference, his whole plan is that he doesn't need arrows because he's going to catch his enemy's arrows out the air and then fire them back. It's incredible.
It's so fucking badass. I wish there was like an RPG that could really capture this. If it's out there, I haven't found it yet, but I must. Anyway, that dude loses in the fight, but gets recruited into Temujin. That's the real name of... I said Genghis Khan a bunch. It's Chinggis. That's the, like, more authentic pronunciation, apparently. And actually, interesting was that voice actor, I think, pronounced it Genghis Khan, not Genghis. And that was interesting to me, being like, oh, that's like, that is a more authentic version. It made me feel like he probably knows his stuff, and I can trust some of these pronunciations. But because Guo Jing is like a good kid and extremely brave and stood up to a bunch of Mongolian soldiers and didn't give this guy away, they adopt him into the Mongolian horde, and they leave behind their, like, shepherd existence, and he starts being trained not to be a kung fu master, as his destiny would tell you. He's being trained to be a member of the Golden Horde. He's about to go rampaging across Eurasia.
This is definitely one of the sections where I kind of sat there and went, gosh, I wish I knew more about this period of history. If a book has ever made me motivated to go out and read about sort of the Mongolian Empire and Genghis Khan, it's like, this has done it. I'm like, oh my god, I need to know.
I've got to say, Duncan, something that made me really like this book is that one of my recent Wikipedia deep dive obsessions has been the Mongol Empire. So this was really expertly timed, because I was having a blast with this.
Just to give real more overview, we're going to go zoom back out a little bit, keep doing the plot, and then we'll come back and dive into things.
You can just sort of skip ahead to when the Seven Freaks show up, right?
Yeah, exactly. They finally find Gore, and I love this bit. There's this lovely farcical bit where they're like, is this the right kid? I'm not sure if this is the right kid. This is just a random kid.
It's so fucking funny. It really feels like they might just skip over him, because they've been gone for like 10 years. Like, they have been looking for this guy for 10 years of their lives. They were heroes. They were like saving people's lives, and they've had to put all of that on pause to win a bet. And you're like, they might leave. They might just get it wrong. They might say, this kid is not worth it.
This section ends, though, with them going, no, Guo Jing, this is the one we're looking for. They start training him. There's a good section on him being trained, and they're like, he's not actually that good. Oh dear. And then there's a great section. There's a load of like Mongolian politics and the actual rise of Genghis Khan to like take over the Mongolian nation and unite the tribes, which was fantastic.
This really felt like Jing Yong is a nerd for Mongolian history, because I think there can be no other explanation for a Chinese author being like, yeah, my hero's first like big heroic act is like saving the life of Genghis Khan, one of history's worst mass murderers. Like, a sizable portion of East Asians have his DNA because of how many women he raped. And he's like, yes, we're gonna save Genghis. Oh no, he's in danger. Somebody do something. What the hell?
And I'll be honest, why I really enjoyed it about this, that when you're reading this section of the book, I was fully brought into the idea that this was the story. And then when this section wraps up and Guo Jing, they're like, okay, Guo Jing, you've got to head back over to the Jin Empire. You've got to head back into China. You know, you've got your whole destiny thing to deal with. And you're like, oh yeah, I forgot. Sod, I forgot the setup. Yes, avenge father, meet up with sworn blood brother he's never met. Yes, I obviously, this bit, this is the plot. And then we go for the next, I don't know, last third quarter-ish of the novel, is then Guo Jing re-entering, I'm going to call it civilization, I don't know if that's the wrong terminology, urban environment.
You just say China.
Yeah, re-entering China. The seven freaks somehow have to bounce for slightly, I'm not going to lie, reasons that just kind of came across as, yeah, you want them out of this bit of the plot. Sure.
Yeah.
And then you've got this whole other questline where he goes into a city, he meets a little street urchin whose pronouns get swapped back and forth for bloody ages before it's explained.
This is just a bad translation. This is obviously just a mistake. Because the character's initial name is, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but Huan Rong. And in the translation, she's called Lotus Huan. And the narration says, he said his name was Lotus, but because Guo Jing was not a good Chinese speaker, he speaks better Mongolian, he didn't understand what was meant by the name. So to a Chinese reader, they're saying, oh, that's a girl's name. So Huan Rong is a girl. She's only disguised as a street urchin. But for me, it's like, he didn't understand the implication of the name. And I'm like, well, I don't know what Lotus means. I don't know anything. Is that saying, like, it's a classy name? Or is it, like, some sort of spiritual thing? Are they, a goddess or something? What's the deal? I don't know.
No, absolutely. And it sort of leads you in this weird back and forth where I'm like, well, that's odd. And ultimately, I think the way I interpreted this is that they're clearly, they're a woman, but they're kind of in a male disguise. But depending on who's speaking and whose perspectives.
But the pronouns thing was weird, because the pronouns switched without there being any revelation. At a certain point in the book, Guo Jing learns that Lotus is a girl and is actually a very beautiful girl. Which did confuse me, because he is betrothed at this point, and it felt like he really did like that other girl, Genghis Khan's daughter, and I'm like, oh, this is not really what I expected to happen at this point. I thought we'd already found our love interest, but no, this is apparently our main love interest, and she's really good at kung fu, which is great. She's actually way better than him, and I liked that a lot. I liked that she was, like, one of the most badass characters in the book.
I think it's just generally nice that our main character isn't super special.
No.
In the sense that the main observation is that they're not very good at kung fu, but it's the fact that they have, you know, that kind of iron sense of right, wrong,
yes,
and will stand by their principles.
Exactly.
That makes them special.
What I really like about this book is, to put it in Dungeons and Dragons terms, when we meet our first heroes, when they show up, they're like level 4. So they're crazy good. Like, compared to the average person, they're like a hero. And then a level 12 martial artist walks onto the scene. And then you spend the rest of a book meeting level 7s, level 9s, and level 15s. And there are always people who are stronger, ready to show up at any time. And that happens all the time in, like, martial arts films. There's all these occasions where you watch, like, Drunken Fist, and you go, oh, Jackie Chan's character is basically unbeatable when he first shows up. He fights off tons and tons of guys. And then one guy shows up, and it's like, oh, no, you are nothing compared to this guy. And then by the end of the movie, Jackie Chan's character beats him. Or if anyone shows up with a long white beard, you're like, oh, you're screwed. There's nothing you can do to this guy.
But what continues to play out in this end section, and I'm going to shoot through it, this plot basically surrounds the fact that Guo Jing runs into a father and daughter pair who are doing some sort of like martial competition to pick out the daughter's suitor. Then no one can seem to beat her, key point. And then some arrogant aristocrat rides in, does beat her.
But does so dishonorably.
That's right. Doesn't play by the rules.
He wins, and then he steals her shoe, and also, he steals her shoe and then sniffs it. So, like, okay, that was weird. That's how you know this guy's evil. He's a pervert.
I don't have anything more to add to that. It was weird. He's clearly shown this being, like, quite... He's a despicable character who's kind of making light and dishonouring this young woman. And Gore, obviously, is like, excuse me, you should not dishonour a young woman. There's some fighting. One thing that's clear is that he will
use...
A lot of fighting. Some underhand tactics. Another fight just runs into this fight. And other characters just show up. And they're not like... You're like, oh, are they going to start fighting Gore too? And they're like, oh no, they're not interested. They have their own stuff going on. The key point to all this is that there's some back and forth, and we have this... It turns out that this aristocrat, this Wang Yin Kang, he eventually kidnaps this young woman and father because basically he doesn't want his master to hear how naughty a boy he's been. We get to see that his mother is a tender soul and not quite aware of how awful her son is. And then this all builds up to a climax where Guo and the father... A son called Mu Yi are hiding near the Wang Yin Kang's mother's rooms before finally realizing that the consort, as she's been referred to for this whole book, Wang Yin Kang's mother, is in fact it's Chastity from the beginning. And then Mu Yi goes, my love, I have found you again, for he is Ein Hart Yang. And then you go, oh my god, revelations! But one more revelations for this consort, her son. It is not the son of the evil prince, man. He is Ironheart Yang's son. But he's about to kill his father, for he has discovered her in his mother's quarters.
So I have only two notes I took for this book. But the first one says, end of chapter for the maiden. Right at the end of that chapter is when you get that first big hint about this dude's identity. And... it is easily the best plot twist in the entirety of the podcast. I don't think anything we've covered so far comes close to how wide my jaw fell open. I gasped audibly. My notes say my brain is popping like a Rice Krispie bowl.
Beautiful. Even in his notes just from...
It's amazingly delivered. Like, you get just enough hints for you to go, oh my god! And it drives up the drama so much. These are not strangers. There's a moment where you're worried that, like, oh yeah, one Yang Kang is a pervert to this girl. Is that his sister? Thankfully, no, not his sister. She's adopted. But yeah, it drives up all of the drama because the whole point of Guo Jing's journey is he's supposed to go to this city, go to this pub, and meet his, like, blood brother and fight him for the sake of the honor of Eternal Spring, the Taoist monk, and the Seven Freaks of the South. People have died to make this happen. Empires may have been forged to make this one fist fight happen. And they have actually not only already fought, but they have fought multiple times before they're able to like, fulfill this. They only just figure out one another's identity, or rather, Wang Yang Kang doesn't really get it at the end of his book, his part of the book, but they only just figured out in the final chapter of his book.
And this book ends on a a cliffhanger. Like, when they were cutting up the volumes, they were being bastards. Because it ends with Wen Yang Kang, like, wounding his father only upon discovery of the truth.
His mother.
He wounds his mother, who throws herself in the way of his father. And you're like, oh, the drama.
Yeah. Yep.
And then it ends. And I was like,
I was livid, Duncan, when this book ended. And I was like, oh my God, this has been the most tempting time in actual years that I've been to just keep the series going. And I'm not going to do that because we only have a couple of episodes left before 100. And I want to get a variety out in that meantime. So sorry. But wow. What a way to leave off a book, to just suddenly stop like that.
And I really want to emphasize, I know, yeah, we're going to go back over, we're going to talk about our highlights. Something about this series, based on the strength of the recommendation that I got, it wasn't until the very end that I finally went, oh, wow. Up until that point, I was like, oh, that's really good. Oh, this is really impressive. This is really fun. And I got to that point and went, oh, I get it now. This is epic. This is empires, yet deep personal drama. And yeah, there are some bits, you know, there was a little bit of my brain was like, oh, it's a bit of a soap opera, isn't it? Oh, and then a bit of my brain, who even cares? He discovered who his father was. They were the family reunited, but the son is now evil. They were meant to be sworn brothers, but now they're on opposite sides of a conflict. I was like, yeah.
They make this very clear. If one of them had been born a girl, they would have been married.
It's kind of a bit of everything in terms of, I was reading this too, and I had this moment of like, gosh, I don't know why, probably because just my influence, but even reading this, I was like, I can even feel like, you know, that last twist of fate. I'm seeing even, you know, talking about Joy Nights, I'm even looking like, oh yeah, I see a bit of Star Wars in this now. I see a bit of all of these other things that I enjoy. Talking about influences, everyone knows, yeah, something like The Matrix influenced by Kung Fu movies, but you really started to see, it's like, oh, so much of the things that I took for granted, ideas, and particularly something, you know, you grew up watching a lot of anime, I went, oh, and I don't want to say this is coming from the Condor Heroes specifically, I know it's from a wider literary canon, but I'm like, ah, oh, I get it, I draw the lines. And I just had so much fun at the end, and I was the same boat as you, I was like,
so...
Sorry, brief.
Let's make something quite plain, okay? We made clear right from the start, Duncan and I don't have the cultural context to talk about how influential this story is. We've been told that, but we can't really tell. But this book was published as a book in 1957, and its first adaptation was in 1958, and it's been adapted, like, 20 times. And in the, like, author's note at the start and at the end, it says it has sold 300 million copies, and if you do unofficial copies, it's likely over a billion.
I just want to pull up some stats, by the way. You say 300 million. I'm just going to say the total amount of copies of Lord of the Rings, for example.
Sure.
The general accepted number for the Lord of the Rings is currently at 150 million.
Wow. This would be a good benchmark. What about the Harry Potter series?
What are total sales? Harry Potter, okay.
Well, hang on. You might want to give us the Philosopher's Stone versus like the series as a whole, because obviously that's a lot of books.
Absolutely. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, total sales. Philosopher's Stone stands at 120 million. Total sales of the Harry Potter series stands at 600 million.
Sure.
Whew.
Genuinely, almost impossible to sell that many copies of a book these days, because society has changed and the publishing industry has changed and media has changed. So there's a good chance that another book, it's going to be a very, very, very long time until something weird happens and that many copies of a book are sold. And this is one which Duncan and I had never heard of. And we do a podcast where we talk about fantasy novels, and we're really big nerds about fantasy. And we like the media which is inspired by this thing. And yet there's this whole other thing, we've never heard of it. And we are obviously missing out.
I couldn't agree more. Humbled is really where I stand when I feel like I understand a genre because I've read a bit of Pulp Fiction or Sword and Sorcery or something from the 1920s. And I'm like, oh, my little Western world.
I think it would benefit us a lot as a podcast to diversify the countries which we're getting from. Because right now, this has already been a really enjoyable experience, and I'm definitely going to keep reading these books. I've already bought the next one. And I think we should do more of it on the podcast. Well, maybe. I don't know. Because on one hand, the book is so big that we haven't even really been able to talk about it the way we do most other books. Because we can only look at it from a big picture. Because so much happens in this, the first quarter of the actual book. Again, this is not the complete book.
It's very true, but it's certainly it's opened my eyes to a subgenre. Not, you know, another realm. Even if we don't cover all of the Condor heroes, I want to experience more of this, is it Wuhai?
Wuxia.
Wuxia. I want to experience more Wuxia novels. I want to pick things from cultures that are different to my own. But also, I do have to really give credit to this book and the translation, despite the small errors that we've brought up, is that this is still good, gripping writing. I'm not just praising it because it's different or it has comparison. This book, and like I said, the first section, I very much had that vibe of, you're setting up the chessboard, maybe you're finding your feet a bit more. Yeah, the fights weren't quite as good early on. It's still just well-written action and fun characters. You know, at no point did I feel that just because I struggled with the names or relating to some of the ideals and philosophies that drive these characters, that I couldn't still attach myself to them as the human beings and understand, you know, their core motivations.
Yeah, they are... They're broad characters. They're big, you know, like, they're almost like, sometimes they're occasionally almost cartoony. Like, when a character is a scoundrel, they're a real scoundrel. And the seven freaks are called the seven freaks for a reason. They're odd people. But you're right, they are engaging. They're fun to read about. And even though it's through the filter of translation, and the translator sort of lays out the sort of fallacy that comes with trying to accurately translate a work, and says that says something which I fundamentally disagree with, where she says the worst thing a translation can do is not exist, because that completely denies people a chance to engage with a story. That's obviously completely wrong. I mean, what an absurd thing to say. Obviously, translations can be worse than not existing, because a bad translation can actually undermine a book, like the Icelandic version of Dracula. Duncan, do you know about the Icelandic version of Dracula?
I certainly do not.
The Icelandic version of Dracula is famous for not adapting Dracula. When it got translated into Icelandic, the guy who was writing it at a certain point went, I could do it better, and stopped adapting Dracula and wrote his own book where he like changed the plot. So it starts off the same. John Von Harker goes to Castle Dracula, and then at a certain point it is about something else.
I think the only counter argument there is then, by definition, that's no longer a translation.
Well, Duncan, where do you draw the line with translation? Because when it comes to doing things like changing character names, what if she hadn't said they're Sky Fury? What if it became Steve, you know? And forget that. What if someone who's translating your book has an agenda? And what if the person who translates it doesn't like China? Like, is a racist. And they talk about how great the Mongolians are and how scheming and scoundrelous the Chinese characters are. That would be, in my opinion, worse than not translating the book if you pervert it, if you change it to suit your ideology.
I do agree with you. It is a devious middle ground, because obviously one of the key things when you do translation is the fact that literal translations, even something as simple as between like English and French, you cannot do, because the way our sentence structure is based is just different. And as a translator, you have to make calls about getting across the meaning and the intent over being literal in what the words are saying.
If I can quote President of the United States, George W. Bush, the problem with the French is they have no word for entrepreneur.
Is that real?
I think so.
Wow. As in, that quote is real. That's what's shocking me. Not the French.
No, apparently that's a lie. That is embarrassing.
That might be one for the editing room floor. Can't lift that one down.
You're censoring me. It's happening, finally. Anyway.
Yes. So, overall though, this is a good translation. This is a fun book. Just kind of some key points to pick out, because we talk, I think, again, quite big picture, but there's so many small picture moments. Geordie, can I just say, although I loved the ending, the actual, like, very tail end was probably my favourite bit of the whole book. I loved the whole section on, like, the Mongolian steppes. Really did. Like, a bit of coming of age. I enjoyed the characters. I particularly liked the sections where Guojing was getting this sort of training, not from his six masters. The whole, like, there's a section where he's meeting with someone else and they're just teaching him to breathe and how to have a, like, empty his mind. And, like, this is improving his ability to...
Yeah, that's Ma Yu.
Is his Shifu. And then his other trainers are like, who is secretly teaching you? And he's like, no one. And they're like, you lie to us. And then he's like, but they're not. They're just helping me, like, calm myself and empty my mind and breathe. And I'm like, oh.
No one's teaching me Kung Fu. All I've been learning to do is, you know, breathe and concentrate and stuff. And like, oh my God, this fucker doesn't know he's been learning Kung Fu. I love how stupid he is. It's perfect.
I love the fact that the seven freaks are literally at this point thinking, like, maybe we'll have to kill him if he's been taught to turn against us. Like,
yes,
been,
they're planning,
like,
to murder
8
him.
Years you've been training this kid who you swore to find his mother, protect, and get to this certain location. And you're like, he's getting... I love the fact that the evidence that he's been trained to attack them is that he's suddenly getting good at his lessons. It's like he's been so crap for 7 years. And all of a sudden, he's having a breakthrough and actually getting good at Kung Fu. And they're like, nope, this is weird. Geordie, you challenged me on that, though, that being my favourite bit. What was your favourite section of the book?
No, I mean, there were a lot of points in the Mongolian section where it got quite dull. And not because nothing was happening, sometimes because those fights were getting a little bit long. And I was like, oh no, I feel like I'm losing focus here. Like, watching all seven freaks of the South fight Iron Corpse, very cool name. Iron Corpse and Copper Corpse, or Hurricane Chen. That fight goes on for such a long time. It's just these, like, evil kung fu masters show up and they have a showdown where everyone's fighting one another. Everyone is, in fact, kung fu fighting. And I go, like, oh, I don't feel emotionally connected to the characters of Iron Corpse and Copper Corpse. I appreciate that it's to create, obviously, a longer-term antagonist, because Guojing is the guy to kill Copper Corpse with a, maybe, magic knife? I'm not sure. And Iron Corpse gets blinded, but swears revenge. And despite being blind, she's able to avoid the seven freaks of the South trying to hunt her across the Gobi Desert, and then returns later to lead an attack. Not lead an attack, but, like, manipulate an attack against Chinggis Khan just to kill this one kid who accidentally killed her husband.
Fair enough. I think particularly for me then, I really enjoyed this first sort of climax though. The section where Chinggis Khan's army, he's being betrayed by Um Khan and his sort of slight sworn brother. Again, this is what I really want to just learn about. And as far as I can tell, a lot of the members of this, I'm going to call it a court, sorry, it's an equivalency I can say, of these Mongolian tribes. Like, I love the politicking around them. I really love the Genghis Khan, the betrayal. And then I really enjoyed the section in this book where he's like, okay, what we're going to do, I'm going to grovel. Afterwards, I'm going to say, I'm so sorry, it's my fault that you tried to betray me. Here, let's pay them off with a bunch of gold. A guy speaks out against Genghis, and Genghis is like, beat that man to death. He should know that it's time to grovel. And then once they're like he really convinces them, like, oh my god, yeah, no, Genghis is just, he's sorry that we tried to betray him. Obviously, we should let him off for this. And then
what a nice guy.
And then the moment they're away, he literally, the guy who gets nearly beaten to death, he's like, I'm very sorry, here, you're getting raised up now, here's a promotion, get everyone together. As soon as they think that I'm sorry and start drinking, because they're going to plan to attack me. So as soon as they're so convinced they let their guard down, we're going in there and we are killing everyone. I was like, okay, this man's serious.
Yes, I liked it too. I especially right at the start where it's about the interaction between the Mongolian politicking and the Jing Empire. Because I remember learning about these different titles that are being handed out. And I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure I've actually read about this in history books. Like, this is a scene that's happening. Like, I'm almost watching, you know, like an origin story. I'm watching, like, the Munich Putsch right now.
It's the section where the Jin Empire give Genghis the title, like, putter down of, like, uprisings. And he's just like...
Yes, exactly.
And I love the fact, firstly, it's like, they're not actually giving him anything but a title. And they think, aren't we so nice giving this Mongolian a title? And how Genghis is just like, you can give it to someone else, I don't care. Means nothing to me. So I shouldn't be like fanboying over him that much. He was a terrible person in real life. But the
I know, but that's the thing. The book does. And that's the weird thing about it. Like, dude, listen, it's just odd to me. Granted, it was 700 years ago, but you don't feel bad that it was your like ancestors who were being killed by Genghis Khan? I guess I'm not that emotionally attached to the war, not the War of Roses, the Hundred Years' War. Like, I don't actually have a grudge against the French because of, like, Cressy.
But I'd still have a grudge against William the Conqueror.
Yeah, son of a bitch. Why do we have to learn words which are so ink-horny? We can just use simple... Ah, oh, fuck, simple's French. It's hard. He really did a number on us.
And it can still be felt today. Geordie.
Yeah.
What was your favourite bit of the book, damn it?
I really like Lotus's fight scenes at the end. Both those which happen on the page and not on the page. Because at one point, a group of, like, martial arts bandits shows up, challenges Guo Jing, and is like, we're going to beat the shit out of you because we know you're associated with the Seven Freaks of the South, and we're going to take you guys down. This leader here, he's like the three-horned dragon because he has bumps on his head. And in classic martial arts like story vibes, this is again a misunderstanding because all Guo Jing has to say is, yes, you're right, they are my masters, but they're not here. So I really wish we could challenge you guys to a fight, but they're not around this time, so you're going to have to wait till they show up. But he doesn't say that. They just leave, and he's like, ah, there's no way for me to possibly explain myself. So I have to go out to the woods tomorrow and fight them like we promised. But when he shows up the next day, all of these people are tied up in a tree. And he's down at the bottom. They're yelling curses at him. And he's like, well, I guess I did say I'd show up, and I did. So I fulfilled my end of the bargain. And he leaves. And you think to yourself, okay, who beat these guys? Like, who's the super cool martial artist? Is it, like, is Eternal Spring hanging around? Is that what's happened? And it's only shortly afterwards, during the Maiden fight, where Lotus shows back up and starts being chased by these bandits. And she, they start using she pronouns at this point, so it gives away the twist, is running around and you go, oh, not only are you a cool martial artist, but the thing that makes you a cool martial artist is you're having fun. Everyone else is fighting for honor or for sadism, and you just like this. You're giggling and running around like a kid playing tag with people. And when she fights a bunch of like martial artists at the end, she knows she's beat, but she's crafty and she keeps saying, ooh, I'm just a little girl. You wouldn't hit me for real, right? And she makes them keep accepting various challenges in the middle of the fight. Like, if I can get through that door, you can't fight me anymore, deal? And they're like, yeah, obviously. And then she tricks them into letting her go through the door. And she's like, I win! Stuff like that. So her fights are so entertaining.
They really were. And I really enjoyed her personality. There's a really nice scene where her and Gorjing are on a boat. And Gorjing is like, no, you don't understand. I have to get on my mission. I have to save this guy. He's being poisoned. I've got to break into this compound. And I like the fact that Lotus is just there. And she's like, yeah, but if I've done my maths right, you've got until like maybe tomorrow morning. So we've got time for a spot of lunch.
And the great thing is, when she's introduced, I was convinced she was a villain. She shows up, and obviously something sus about her, because she shows up dressed as a beggar, but has extremely rich taste. And there's a genuinely very funny scene of her ordering food in a restaurant, where she's asking for all this outrageous stuff. And the first time, and kudos to the translators for getting the tone of this right, at first you're like, oh, so you're like a prince in disguise or something, and you're like a snob, and that's why you're ordering all of this extremely specific stuff, like, you know, James Bond ordering caviar level specific. But you realize at a certain point that it's a prank, like it's a joke. She doesn't give a fuck, so she's just giving this outrageous list just to see if people will go along with it. She is a bit young, though.
Sorry?
It's the same twist as when Dior shows up. It's like, oh, you're not a 14-year-old boy, you're a 16-year-old girl. Except you're like, oh, you're the new love interest for our 18-year-old protagonist. Oh, but you're 15. Oh, you're a little young. Ooh.
I'm willing to give it on the account that nothing happens in this first volume, and they'll at least give them both a year or two before something intimate happens. Fingers crossed.
Let's hope. And obviously it's like, you know, obviously it's like medieval China. There's one bit in there about like a woman, it's noted that a woman's feet are unwrapped, and you go, ugh, oh yeah, of course.
I mean, yikes, but also true to the history.
This was written in 57. That probably only just became illegal in China.
Really?
Yeah, Mao Zedong's the guy who made it illegal. And like genuinely one of the good things about it.
Okay, lots to take in there. Back point of my book, though. There's a lot of this book, and I think it's a legitimate thing that someone could throw at us.
Mm.
Is this fantasy? Is it just fantasy? This is...
Yes! Yes, obviously it's fantasy. It's full-on waifu. A guy uses his kung fu skill to drink a full-on barrel of wine and projects the wine out of the soles of his feet. Also, I got a spoiler in the author's notes, and those birds, like the condors, are magic. And his horse is also magic.
Yeah, fair enough. It clearly is. It's just not in that, it's not overt. But there were long stretches where it felt more, you know, historical fiction, particularly in those early Mongolian steppe sections.
It's always interesting to me how one can balance, like, staying close to historical events whilst keeping in the fantastical. Like, we've experienced Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, an amazing example of fidelity to a period whilst authentically and persuasively sprinkling in fantastical stuff. Like, how do you have England be normal when they used to be run by the Raven King, you know? That's a book that does it well. And this one, it probably just cares less. But I'd like to see more stuff like that. Genuinely, over Christmas, Duncan, I had a idea for a story, which I'm happy to share here because I know I'm not going to do anything with it, where I was watching Ridley Scott's Robin Hood, as one does. That's an entertaining bad movie, but it's yeah.
Oh, yes, the let's try and be historically accurate, not weird fun.
Yeah, that it is, it's, Ridley Scott again is famous for not giving a, I don't know. For some reason, I'm a bit more reticent to swear these days on the podcast, and I don't know why. He doesn't give a care about historical accuracy, which people took a lot of offense about with his Napoleon movie. But the point is, I was thinking, how would one do like a fantastical version of Robin Hood? Like, could you do that? And I came up with this genuinely out crazy idea of like, what if Robin as is often depicted in modern adaptations of Robin Hood, he's a former crusader. He's come back to England from the Holy Land. He finds out that England's not doing so hot and he has to change things. And no joke, Duncan, this was probably the influence of Krampus, having just finished that. I was like, what if it's like the war in the Holy Land is like a war in heaven on earth? Like, it's a battle between angels. And the different allegiances are sided with, like, you know, a different group is being led by Gabriel, and the other one is being led by Michael, and they're fighting, like, over Jerusalem to, like, control, like, the birthplace of Christ and that. And then he goes home and it's just like, oh, I've seen actual angels die. I maybe even have slain angels. I could definitely get rid of Christianity from England and bring back the old gods.
I would like to see that. I definitely think Robin Hood has that aspect of being like, he sits alongside English folklore.
Yeah.
So comfortably. I would love to see something that ties some more kind of folkloric tales and sort of the more, using the term, kind of pagan beliefs of the British Isles, and wrap them up around a Robin Hood. This happens quite a lot with King Arthur. King Arthur weirdly straddles both strong pagan beliefs and strong Christian beliefs, and bounces back and forth so regularly.
That makes a lot of sense for Arthur, though, because he's from, like, the 400s. Like, that's where the origins have. So England literally was pagan at that point. Christianity was only just showing up. And obviously Arthur, in later depictions like Le Mort d'Arthur, is, like, a Christian king. Like, and he's good and right because, you know, he's a divinely ordained king. So God has to be on his side. And then people like to play with the idea of paganism in Arthur because it's like, because it straddles that line. Whereas Robin Hood is from the 1100s. Like, at least that's when it's set. And he shows up in like the 13th century. He starts showing up in poems. And obviously England had been Christian for centuries by that point.
But still, would be love to see something kind of explore that. I was going to thought you were going to say you're going to make them all animals, anthropomorphize the lot.
No,
of it.
But I did. I did have a good laugh. That's when the $100 million idea. That what you could do is you could have Little John be like a fairy tale giant. So he's Little John because he's a little giant.
No, that is brilliant.
Anyway, that's a story I'm literally not even writing. So whatever. The point is, we've given this book a huge amount of praise because it's so different and exciting and fun. It's a fun book. I don't want to get away from the fact that I have legitimate complaints. Like, sometimes there is too much people sitting around talking about Kung Fu. And sometimes it is really hard to figure out what people are actually talking about. You know, they're sitting around and they're making, like, veiled threats at one another, and it's pretty hard to keep up with people's personal histories. Like, an important faction in this book is a particular school of Kung Fu, and they are throwing a lot of names at you, and it can be hard to keep up. But my praise for this book is it's overwhelmingly strong. It really is one where you just put aside the stuff you don't like, because the strong stuff is great, and I'm really, really excited to keep reading the books. Or book, singular.
It's books. It is technically a trilogy. There is The Return of the Condor Heroes. And I want to say it's called something like Dragon Saber. It's the final one.
Oh, there was an interesting thing about the translation of this book. Is that a lot of the times people draw swords and it's translated as saber. And I was thinking to myself, oh, that's really interesting. Why have you chosen that word? Why saber? Are you trying to draw a direct line between the type of sword that's being used? Or do you think that just is the right... Is that just a word for sword which you like? Like, I know that, for example, if someone said it's a Chinese saber, I'm thinking, I don't know what that means. Because all the Chinese swords I know are straight swords and sabers are curved swords. What do you think saber means?
All I want to kind of add on to that, I've just gone and looked at the third book, and it's called The Heaven Sword and Dragon Saber.
Hell yes! Heaven Sword, Dragon Saber. Oh, so cool.
No, what I also love is at the top of the page, it has a little section going, also translated as The Sword and the Knife.
Boo!
That's not nearly as good.
Boo! There's a whole section, the epilogue, about, like, where it's like, the author, the translator says, so, why is this called The Legend of the Condor Heroes? Because there are no condors in this book. And I loved that. That was so funny to me.
Good night, Zoe. And just to finally put the final piece de resistance on that statement, there's another bit underneath that that goes, the literal translation is, the story of the Heaven Reliant and Dragon Slayer.
Oh my god, that's so cool.
How did you get from that?
It's sort of like
how we got from one to another.
So this is a struggle which a lot of people have. And I'm going back to anime again, even though I know there's a difference in Japanese media and Chinese media, even though we've explored how they're influential to each other, or at least in one direction in this episode. It's a medium which I have a lot more experience with than Kung Fu movies and Wuxia. But a challenge that's often felt by publishers when they're translating these works is just, what do you call the series? So, for example, Hajime no Ippo. No one has ever bothered to try and translate Hajime no Ippo because it's a joke and it can't translate. Hajime means first in Japanese. No is something like of or relating to, and Ippo is the main character's name. So it sounds like it's beginning of Ippo. But Ippo, the main character's name, means foot. So Hajime no Ippo means the first steps. And it's about someone beginning their boxing career. So that joke, it can't translate. You could call it the first steps, but you wouldn't realize that that's a joke. It's a pun. Anyway, I only go on about diatribe because I find translating very interesting. And the compromises who people make to bring them about. And that whole Icelandic Dracula thing.
It's worth just quickly noting as well, that also goes both ways. I have had a very close Polish friend that I worked with who kind of explained to me, you know, he watched, I believe it's the Monty Python film,
sure,
The Holy Grail, dubbed into his own language. And he said what the most weirdest thing is, when he came to England and he watched it with his partner, he realised that the jokes were completely different because so many references just don't carry over. So they just kind of made up, like, I can't remember the exact example, but basically, if they were derogatory towards a location, they would change it to a local Polish location so people got the joke. So it is a very...
Sure.
It's a,
like how the Swedish chef is called, like, the Norwegian chef in Sweden.
That's to not offend. Dordi, let's bring this episode to a close. We've had a lot of praise for this first volume of The Condor Heroes, A Hero Born, but I think the real question we have to say answer is, who do we recommend this to? Who do you recommend this to? I know who I would. It's a very simple answer. One word, in fact.
Well, my answer is not everyone, if that's what you're about to say.
Mine is everyone. I'm just like, give it a go. Tell for yourself.
No, I wouldn't recommend this to everyone because I know a lot of people who love books. They're not going to be able to handle it. I don't mean this as like an insult or something. You're just going to read it and be like, oh, this is a bit too much for me. This is a bit too much going on. I think if you like historical fiction, then go for it. If you read fantasy, but you also like stuff like anime and you want something that's kind of close to that in vibes, or and which so you have a sort of level of tolerance for martial arts bullshit, go for it there. But I can't recommend it to everyone. If you like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, I can't guarantee you're going to like this book. If you like Brandon Sanderson, actually, I probably would recommend this to someone who likes Brandon Sanderson. That's a bad example.
For me, I say everyone just because I found this so different to my field of experience that I kind of have to be like, I wouldn't know. I don't have enough strong reference points. I'd be like, give it a go. It's going to probably be different. And it's okay if you don't love it.
I mean, let's put it this way. If you met someone and said, I love fantasy, my favourite book last year was Fourth Wing, this wouldn't be my first recommendation to them.
No, okay, fair enough. That's a very good counterpoint.
I hope that if you've listened to this episode, and granted, we've spoiled a lot, including an amazing plot twist, you should probably know if you like this. Hell, if you like Kung Fu movies, watch this one. A lot of people don't watch Kung Fu movies, which is weird. At least watch Rumble in the Bronx. at least rumble in the Bronx. Come on. Duncan, if you had to recommend a kung fu movie to our listeners, what one would it be? Mine is Rumble in the Bronx.
Oh, that is a good one. I do like... Now, as I was about to say this name, I am like, wait, is that a reference? Because I do like Operation Condor.
I don't know Operation Condor.
It's a Jackie Chan one.
But which one is it? Was it when? Like 90s, the 80s, when?
Sorry, no, cut that. I've just said the wrong name. It's not. That's something completely different. So let me actually look up the name of the one I'm thinking of. Wait, no, sorry. I'm speaking absolute bullshit. It just didn't come up when I Googled it. Operation Condor is a Jackie Chan movie. It's called Armor of God 2, Operation Condor.
That's right. I remember now. Armor of God. I think there's a very confusing publishing history to that one. Duncan, thank you for introducing this to the podcast, and thank you to your partner's cousin for sharing that. I hope you have a whole stack of other books, because we'll definitely revisit this series after we do our 100th episode. But in the meantime, we really do need to pack on and move on towards our 100th. And that means it's my turn to introduce something to the podcast. Oh, and to bend the rules slightly, Duncan, because this is not, like, the next book in this series we read isn't a sequel, I think either of us can pick the next book in this series, because we're actually just continuing the one book, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. That is a perfect loophole in our rules. Ladies and gentlemen who are new to the podcast, we do have a rule. Only the person who didn't bring the first book in the series to the podcast can pick to continue it. That way, I can't drag Geordie through the entirety of Wheel of Time against his will.
Okay, so...
So yes, Geordie, what do you want to read next? You've said that you want to hit some big ones out before we get to our 100th book. So I'm assuming you've got something really like a passion project or a big name.
So what I also said, Duncan, in our previous episode was I wanted to get some of the new highlights of the series, and I also wanted to get some of the lowlights. And Duncan, you're going to help me pick. I've got a £1 coin on my hand, and I need you to call heads or tails. Depending on what comes up, we're either going to do a really good book for the next episode, or one that I think is going to be really bad.
Okay. So what, if I win the toss, we do a good book?
Yes.
Here we go, people. Now, I have to let you know, there is no camera on Geordie, so I can't even tell if he's being legit with this.
Duncan, this is a matter of honour, and now you've challenged my honour, so we have to meet up in 18 years' time after training a prodigy to be the greatest podcaster of all time. How dare you?
And I will meet you on that day.
I flipped the coin. I have it covered up, Duncan. What's it going to be?
It shall be the king's head.
Duncan, it is a head.
Yes! Good book!
I mean, I hope so. And it's funny, they actually brought it up before, because the next book we're going to be doing, I'm going off on holiday, so we might not be able to get another episode out this month, we have to see. And because of that, I decided we would do a long one. And I'm bringing about the prophecy early. The book we are going to be doing is The Eye of the World, the first book in the Wheel of Time series by Robert Jordan.
The time has come. I cannot wait. This will be a reread for me. I believe this will be a first time for you, Geordie.
It certainly will.
This is going to be a big one.
I've seen 2/3 of one episode of the second season of this TV show.
Well, I can tell you now, that was not representative. Not nearly enough of straightening of dresses and tugging of braids. You'll get the references soon. People, thank you for listening. It's been so great to come back for another year and another series of the It's Just Fantasy podcast. If you want to reach out, tell us your thoughts. If you've read The Legend of the Condor Heroes, tell us your thoughts on Wheel of Time. I'm sure there'll be many. The best place, as always, is our Instagram. Is This Just Fantasy? That'll be the place to also check out when the new episode releases and little tidbits in between reviews, opinion pieces to tide you over.
Till next time, I've been your host.
Geordie.
And I've been your other host.
Duncan.
So long.
Bye.